Thursday night edition of the Dunktime Basketball Podcast. We finally have a close game to talk about, Golden State-Houston, which was a bit of a classic, even though Steph didn't play and there were some little foibles down the end. There was some great drama. We also had Toronto retaking control of the series against Indiana, Oklahoma City doing the same against Dallas, and then our long-awaited all-defense teams from the award pod a couple of weeks ago. We finally think we'll have some time to do that today. I'm joined, as often, by Danny.
I am shocked that you called that Warriors-Rockets abomination a classic.
Yeah, as soon as I said it, you'd notice I sort of like began walking back a little bit. It was an abomination. It's a good game.
It was entertaining. It was the entire last 5 minutes of that game could be accompanied by Yakety Sacks, which doesn't make it bad. It just makes it different.
Everything is relative, though.
Yes, that's true.
Because compared to the rest of these playoffs, it is a classic. But let's get to Toronto and Indiana first. Indiana really just has not been able to score in this series. That's been the salient point, I would say. And that didn't particularly change, you know, other than Paul George going completely crazy with both points and assists in game one. They just have not really been able to get loose. I think Indiana's defense has largely been fine. But aside from that, they really have got to figure out a way to score, and I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, they only played Lavoie Allen 8 minutes, so I can't kill him too much. And the other major part of this game for me was Damari Carroll playing a lot of minutes and playing well.
Yeah, Paul George, 42 minutes, but only 6 out of 19 from the field, 1 out of 8 from 3. Did not get the quality of looks that he had had. He ended up 12 of 12 from the line with 25 points, but a lot of that happened late in garbage time. Also, 4 turnovers for George as well. He did have 6 assists too, but Carroll finally gave the Raptors something that they really just had not had, which is someone with both the length and intensity to really make life difficult for George. And it was just little things like denying him the ball, you know, just not letting him get exactly to the spot that he wanted, having enough length to contest. I mean, he just clearly seemed to be looking better physically on both ends.
Yeah, and it was incredibly noticeable. And I mean, you could see it from the way he was playing, but also when you get to the end of the game and his minute count is 35, then you're like, okay. So it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just the intensity. It was that he was doing it and sustaining it. So that's a big thing for the Raptors because he is their best perimeter defender by a mile and a half or a kilometer and a half, whatever.
No, that would be
closer to 2 kilometers, but
in any event, yeah, I thought that Jan Mahimi was pretty clearly limited for the Pacers. He's trying to gut through a back injury, and then Miles Turner was the only Pacer who shot over 50%. They shot 38% overall, 6 out of 22 from 3. The only thing that salvaged them was getting to the foul line for 33 attempts. But yeah, it was just, and a fair amount of those happened late too. So it was just a great defensive performance by the Raptors. They put up 101, but they actually took 94 shots to do it. They only shot 42% themselves, but they did manage to get 15 offensive rebounds. The Pacers turned it over 16 times, so they outshot the Pacers 94-68, and even with the about a 17 free throw advantage, that only adds another 8 shots basically to that ledger. So the Raptors effectively got about 18 more shooting possessions in the game than the Pacers did.
Yeah, and that's a way to do it if you're not having efficiency. I thought, even though his box score line wasn't that great, I thought Bismack Biyombo did a pretty solid job in this game.
Yeah, he was really good defensively, and really when the Raptors were able to break it open again was against the bench unit for the Pacers at the beginning of the second quarter. Vogel did the exact same thing with George Hill in this game that he did with Paul George in the last game, and that he got into foul trouble early, 2 fouls, and then he sat him out for the 6 minutes of the first quarter. But, when Steve Kerr, if like Steph Curry gets into foul trouble, he'll bring him back at the start of the second, break his normal rotation because he's already gotten his rest when he's been out. But Vogel did not do that. Would you care to guess how many fouls George Hill finished with after picking up 2 in the first quarter?
He had 1 more than his assists. He had 3 fouls and 2 assists.
When you're staring at the box score, these games just aren't as fun. But yeah, and that was another thing you mentioned, assists. The Pacers had 16 assists. That was actually probably more on their 26 field goals. But their passing overall was so bad. in this game. And not even necessarily like, you know, the ability to identify targets, but just physically putting the ball in the right spot. Every pass was like behind someone. It was getting deflected. They really just were not able to put the ball on target, even when this team of kind of mediocre passers was able to pick somebody up.
And it was weird because you think about, oh, well, you know, if they play small, maybe that'll help. Lavoie Allen played 8 minutes. Jan Mahinhe played 23. Miles Turner played 31. And Jordan Hill played one, you know, at the very, very end. So it wasn't like they played big and just were slow and couldn't move the ball very well. They were playing small guys. They just couldn't pass.
What's left in Frank Vogel's quiver right now to try and juice this offense up a little bit?
Play Monte more with the second unit. Play CJ Miles more with the first. Go small earlier, not play Lavoie Allen with the starters early, that kind of a thing. I mean, the downside there is possibly getting Dwayne Casey out of playing Scola, but I think that you have to try it at this point, especially when not only did the Raptors win this game, but they looked very good. Like, this looked more like the Toronto team that we both and a lot of other people expected to see this entire series.
Yeah, DeRozan still really struggled, but he at least was able to get to the foul line, so he wasn't, although he still managed to be minus one. Lowry hit 4 out of 10 threes, at least 8 out of 21 overall. So he, you know, was relatively efficient. He had 8 assists as well. Looked like he was started to find his three ball a little bit, which was, you know, that's the biggest thing that's a concern. Him being able to hit that shot off the dribble when the other team, you know, goes under on the pick and roll is a big, really important thing for Toronto's offense and allowing them to break the paint and drive and kick, get some ball movement, which, you know, they're not really known for themselves either. So I thought that was big. Corey Joseph, again, had 10 points, 5 out of 10 from the field. He and 4 assists. He dominated Ty Lawson in Lawson's 6 minutes. And Vogel, to his credit, at least in the second half, did change up. He brought Monte Ellis back in as the backup point guard to start and left Paul George in, too. And it just didn't work. Like, the Lowry plus bench unit with Carroll in this time, because Paul George was still in, that Lowry plus bench unit still lengthened the lead at the start of the fourth quarter as well, even with Indiana having more of their starters on the floor. So, you know, it's hard to say even that was the downfall of Vogel, because that all bench plus Lowry unit was still dominant anyway.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Anything else you have on this game?
Yeah, a couple more things. I do think playing Miles more would be good. I think you got to start him. Now, they are getting completely destroyed on the offensive glass. And Valanciunas, Carroll, with his effort, both those guys had 4 offensive rebounds, 15 offensive rebounds total for the Raptors. But, I mean, the bigger problem is just that they cannot score. And Miles only played, you know, he's really the only bona fide shooter other than George. And Miles hasn't played that well. Like, don't get me wrong. But at least you feel like you have to guard him out there. He only played 8 minutes in this one. So I would start him. I would do it as late as possible. I would hope that you could get a few minutes again with him against Scola at the start, get off to a decent start offensively, which, you know, they really just have not. They've been down from the jump, basically, these last two games because they couldn't score at all. And yeah, I mean, try to play George Hill some more minutes. Again, he only played 33 minutes, partially due to the foul trouble. But yeah, not a ton of answers for this team. I mean, there's a reason that they were in the mid-20s in offense. And, you know, they're just not a great executing team. You know, there's no flow. A lot of the screens they set aren't that great. They don't have great passers. So, and then maybe, you know, Miles Turner got to play a little bit more. But, you know, he's not as good of a defensive rebounder as Mahinhe, so that's a problem. But he had 17 points. I mean, he's got to be out there, I guess, just to so you can get some scoring as well.
My feeling is that the Pacers will bounce back a little bit and they'll win game four. But I'm more open to Toronto winning and basically taking real control of this series than I was before this game.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and I thought they really did restore order in that game, too, just defensively. You know, I do think that their style of offense has not worked that well. And the fact that DeRozan, too, just still cannot get going at all on Paul George. Like, he got to the line a little bit. The Pacers really, for whatever reason, were not that fastidious about making sure that George was on him, especially in the first quarter when he was able to kind of get off a little bit. And then when George was back on him all the time in the second half, then, you know, DeRozan just tried to take him, and he's got to just give up on the hubris there. Like, he's a bad shot taker and sometimes a bad shot maker, but if Paul George is in the area, like, he's just not going to get a good shot off. Like, he just has to accept that, move the ball, and, you know, let someone else do it, unless he's got a clear advantage, which I said on previous podcasts. But nonetheless, the fact that those guys haven't been able to be that good doesn't matter, because Indiana has just even more problems scoring than the Raptors have.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, the last thing, too, Seth had a tweet about this. The Pacers strength coach is going to put a poster up of Valanciunas in the weight room for Miles Turner to stare at for 5 hours a day this summer, because Valanciunas just was destroying Turner on the offensive glass. Valanciunas had 4 offensive rebounds in 27 minutes, and Turner only had 3 defensive rebounds and picked up numerous fouls as well, trying to box out on Valanciunas. All right, let's move on to Golden State and Houston. But first, I want to tell you about Betterment. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace. It is the largest independent automated investing service out there. You've probably been hearing about them in TechCrunch, the Wall Street Journal, other news. And the reason why is Betterment makes it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest. It's built on smarter, cutting-edge technology to let you engage in sophisticated investing and get good financial advice, all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services. More than 150,000 customers have chosen Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their dollars. This is the perfect time to get started with Betterment, and saving for your retirement or other financial goals is the right move now, because my listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees. You can learn how at that betterment.com/capspace URL. Betterment.com/capspace, investing made better. So let's get to this awesome, unbelievable classic of a game, Golden State versus Houston. Your initial thoughts?
It is remarkable that the Warriors were this close in a game on the road when Stephen Curry didn't play, Draymond Green played probably his worst game of the season, Klay struggled, he was a little bit better, Harrison Barnes did almost nothing in the game. Like, you think about the reasons that this Warriors team won 73 games, and very few of those were front and center. The guy who was front and center instead was Maurice Spates.
Yeah, Spates was fantastic in this one, hit 3 threes in the first half. That is something that really has rejuvenated his career. And you remember, he was horrendous at the start of the year, basically through the entire Luke Walton era. And, you know, you could say what you want, and I have many times, and we'll get to Ian Clark too, about Kerr kind of overplaying his bench guys and, you know, this whole kumbaya, like, I have confidence in you guys, when, you know, they're frankly just not very good. But he's gotten a lot out of Spates. Now, it helps that Spates has kind of played himself into shape as well, and it helps that Spates is now shooting three-pointers, which he really wasn't so much accepted in garbage time before that. And Kerr encouraged him to start taking threes. And it's really, you know, now he's a solid player, especially going up against a traditional big. And, you know, he's not great on defense, but he doesn't get killed except, you know, rarely in pick and roll by some of the best pick and roll players. And, you know, he can hold up okay on the boards, and he provides space and scoring for the second unit when Steph is out of the game. He's actually having, like, a pretty nice story of redemption in these playoffs after being horrendous in last year's playoffs.
He is a really nice counterweight because he enjoys the role of basically pulling the other center out and making them uncomfortable. That's why he's done a nice job on Dwight in the series. Dwight had by far his best game of the series so far in this one. And Spates kind of bedevils those kind of guys because they want to stay in the lane. They want to be that rim protector, that shot blocker. And Spates doesn't care. He's just going to stand out there and he's going to jack up shots. And I will bring in for the first time in the Dunked On podcast this thing that Kevin Pelton and I have gotten engaged in, which is Maurice Spates threes versus Hassan Whiteside assists, which is now 4-1 for Spates threes in the playoffs.
That's true. We should talk a little bit about the Rockets first. I mean, we're focusing a little bit on the Warriors, which we probably shouldn't. I think that some Rockets had really good games. Howard was one of them, and we'll go through the excruciating detail of those last few possessions too. But yeah, he looked like the guy from last year's playoffs. I mean, he still wasn't scoring in the post the way he was two playoffs ago, but he was really getting up for alley-oops. He was fighting hard for every offensive rebound. The biggest difference was that he actually was playing defense out in the perimeter when he like stepped out on Klay Thompson a few times when he would get a down screen. That he was a big part of why Klay wasn't able to get off. Trevor Ariza also did a really nice job on Klay in this one. Another reason, too, is that the Warriors' defense was so bad in the first half that they couldn't get any stops and get into transition for Klay. You know, Howard had another play where he rotated out to Andre Iguodala in the corner, broke down into a stance. Andre tried to drive by him, and Howard actually moved his feet and cut him off. So, you know, it would seem that perhaps at least maybe he was feeling better today, too, or maybe he was feeling like he needed to show potential free agent suitors that he still is slightly capable of playing this way. Whatever the reason, he was much much better, and he really caused problems for the Warriors on the offensive glass as well. And Houston ended up with 16 offensive rebounds, 6 of which were by Howard, another 5 of which were by Dennis Mataunas, who also was a positive factor in his 31 minutes.
He was a positive factor. I thought Demo didn't play as hard of defense, but he did do some nice things out there. And, you know, he's a guy who can be a contributor. I don't feel like he's a long-term starter, but he did a nice job today, and another guy who was in a pending free agent.
Yeah, restricted free agent. He hit a couple of threes, which I think the first couple that he took, the Warriors almost had forgotten that that was like supposed to be part of his game. He just has been, you know, trying to post up on Draymond Green the entire series to little effect. And he also was okay on defense, took a couple of charges that were big plays as well. Draymond had one of his worst offensive games, so Demo did decently enough on him. So that was a big part of the Rockets' success as well. And then James Harden had one of his better games as well. The Warriors still no discipline reaching. The two guys that always get caught are Draymond and Iguodala, theoretically the two best defenders, guys who are really good with their hands. Normally, that's part of what makes them great defenders. But when they do that, Harden just extends the ball so much further than you expect and goes right through their arms and gets calls, especially in the first half. That was a big part of Harden's success.
And he's such a good free throw shooter that he can have a game where he's only 11 of 26 from the field. Isn't bad. You know, it's a little bit lower than you'd like, but 9 of 11 from the line, so he ends up with 35 points.
Yeah. Andre was just absolutely asleep on both ends in the first half in this one. You know, just his jumper was way off. He was just kind of not engaged at all. On Harden was a little bit better in the second half, but obviously, you know, Harden hit the game-winning shot on him, and I think Andre kind of let himself be pushed a little bit and then realized that, oh yeah, I'm not going to get that call, and then it was too late. He couldn't get a contest at all on Harden's game winner. You know, Harden even had a dunk, which, you know, he kind of never has anymore.
A nice dunk, too.
Yeah. I mean, you like when we talk about his declining athleticism, like you remember he used to have one of those a game, you know, back in the day, and he was able to backdoor Clay and throw it down on, I forget.
I think it was Spates didn't really contest it.
Yeah. So Harden played a great game. Let's see.
Can I put one of your notes in here, which is just Azili, dead question mark?
Yes. Just,
so I can explain. So he played
just like Linguo, the grammar robot.
Yes. So Azili, Bogut got 2 early fouls, so they had to take him out. They brought in Azili, which is standard operating procedure. Azili had this incredibly strange stretch where he was being very aggressive, which was good, but he was kind of forcing some shots and forcing some passes, which is bad. And he also got 2 fouls, so they pulled him. And in one of the more surprising moves early on, they played James Michael McAdoo instead of going to either Draymond or Maurice Spates, which, you know, was a mistake. And Azili came out and never went back in.
Yeah, I would have at least tried him instead of McAdoo. I mean, he had the 2 fouls, but, you know, what is it? I mean, was he playing so badly that he just needed to go out and they thought McAdoo could do a better job? You know, they're getting killed on the defensive glass. That's the one thing that Azili is by far the best defensive rebounder on the team. So he certainly would have helped there at least. You know, he had he missed one monster dunk and then had another one just thrown back in his face in pretty embarrassing fashion by Howard. But I think, you know, I would have at least tried to go back to him a little bit over McAdoo, who just, you know, is not good enough, doesn't communicate well enough defensively.
And the issue also on top of that is, I don't think it was because of foul trouble, but if it was, that doesn't really matter if you're not going to play a guy very much. You know, if he gets a third or even a fourth foul, if you're even debating whether he's going to play very much in that game, then just let him play.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's not like, oh, we got to save him, Festus Azili, when we have 2 other centers who are playing well. Bogut got destroyed in this one. He said after the game that he, you know, alluded to the fact that there's some problem with the refereeing. He had 4 fouls in 15 minutes, but the bigger problem was just that Dwight Howard was just way stronger than him and actually asserted that and got deep, really deep post position on him a couple of times. So that was not Bogut's best game, and that's just kind of the story of how he is in Golden State these days. You know, he has an unbelievable game on Tuesday, and then he hits a couple of early fouls and just never gets into the game. From the Houston side, I mean, Ariza played 42 minutes. You know, he couldn't hit a shot, but, I mean, Houston, 11 of 36 on threes. A lot of those were wide open, too. I mean, I thought that Golden State really got outplayed by Houston much more than the final score indicated.
Agreed. Yeah, they got outplayed. They got out-hustled. And that's strange to say with the Houston Rockets, but that's absolutely what happened.
I mean, 36 three-point attempts. Like, this is a team that should be better on defense without Steph, you would think. And they just made a lot of uncharacteristic errors, you know, just blowing switches, especially involving Monty Unis. Like, Draymond Green just, like, wouldn't switch out on Harden. Like, the four-point play that Harden had in the second half, which was an enormous play, as the Warriors had gotten within six, and then that pushed the lead back up to 10. Draymond just had, like, his hands, like, on his thighs, you know, as Demo was setting the screen. And for whatever reason, Draymond was not really ready to go.
And then, like, he
mentally
did,
or physically, it seems.
I don't want to call it a fake hustle contest because it was more than that, but it wasn't much more than that because the ball was basically already gone when he got there. And then he might have been mad that Harden kicked his legs out, but if you actually are there, they're never going to call that foul.
Yeah, that's right. And it was, I mean, that was a foul. Like, I don't think he even kicked his legs out.
No, it was
badly.
A foul.
Like, you know, both of his feet landed, and Dre also had seven turnovers in this one as well, which I don't remember being mentioned on the broadcast to counteract his seven assists. So yeah, it was Clay was 0 of 7 on threes as well. I thought that the Warriors screening was nowhere near as good as it normally is. You know, they weren't really able to force switches, and you know, Trevor Ariza did a great job denying Clay the ball a fair amount as well. The Rockets did not need to switch nearly as often onto Clay, because that's actually what killed them in game two, was having to switch and then Clay being able to drive. That play was not really there. You know, Ariza just did a much better job on that. So, you know, the Rockets definitely played much better, especially defensively. Michael Beasley also, you know, had his typical line of 12 points and being negative 10. So any other thoughts you had before we kind of break down those crazy last few possessions?
Nope, they'll all be in that last few possessions. There will be at least one tirade, probably two.
So, you know, obviously I was killing Kerr's decision to go with Ian Clark, and I said, you know, if you play one of McAdoo or Clark 15 minutes in the first half, you're not going to win a playoff game. And then, of course, Clark was fantastic, playing almost the entire fourth quarter over Harrison Barnes. And you know, this is one of those times where, like, the recency bias paid off for the coach, because Clark had a couple of nice buckets towards the end and assists to Iguodala, as well as, you know, the Warriors, again, in the clutch, were able to turn up the defense and come back from an eight-point deficit with about five minutes to go. I mean, why don't we pick it up with you know, Clark's floater with about a minute 20 left, and then the Warriors had a chance to go up by three, and then Draymond Green got called for an over-the-back breaker, you know, an offensive foul going for an offensive rebound, which I thought was a pretty, pretty touchy call.
It was a touchy call, but he forced it in a way that was unnecessary.
I disagree. I mean, I think, like, to me, he was going for the ball, and, you know, he got two hands on the ball. You know, it wasn't like, okay, I pushed with my other hand, and, you know, I landed, and then, you know, two other guys jumped, and he kind of contacted them, but it seemed like, you know, none of those guys had any more of a right to that space than any of the others. They were just kind of all going for the ball, and at the very least, they could have just called the ball out of bounds in favor of Houston. The only problem there is that, you know, if the ref would have wanted to do that, then there's an automatic replay, and so it could have ended up being in favor of Golden State. I didn't actually see who it was off of, but still, very touchy call. The other team is in the bonus, and those are called over-the-back breakers for a reason, because you just let the other team go down to the other end and shoot two free throws without having done anything to earn them at all.
Yeah, and not only that, but when you're having a team that's been struggling in their half-court offense, you're even making it easier, especially when they have a decent free throw shooter out there. And I don't know exactly when it happened. I think it was before this, I believe, that J.B. Bickerstaff had, you know, he pulled Dwight when they did hack a Howard once, and then they basically got an opportunity.
With about 3 minutes left, and that was a good play by Kerr to just go to it once, and I understand why he took him
out.
But I understand, I know where you're going to go with this right
so
now.
So then at one, I think it was 1:34 left, there was a stoppage. Kerr called a timeout, and
yeah.
I went, oh, that was a mistake, because now they're going to bring Dwight Howard in. He'd played pretty well. Like, he played a lot better to me in the first half than the second half, but he still played well in the second half. And so they're like, oh, great, they gave them an opportunity to call the timeout, especially because the Warriors weren't really going to make a personnel change at that point. And J.B. Bickerstaff does not bring Dwight Howard in. So I'm just, my ire is just rising, consistently rising, because I understand, you know, being mad at Dwight, you know, for his missed free throws and, you know, things like that on offense-only possessions. But his defense in this game, his effort was great. And at that point, and then far more egregiously with like 30 seconds to go, when it was not a defense-only possession, but as close as you can reasonably get, he still didn't bring Dwight in. And I was incensed.
Yeah, after the Beasley free throws. There was no reason not to bring him back in. Although Beasley was the shooter, so you couldn't have subbed out Beasley. But yeah, I really didn't understand it. Maybe it was because the Warriors were playing with Green at center, and he felt like, all right, Howard just doesn't match up with that. But yeah, I could see that maybe if Steph is in the game, but it's not like that lineup has so much shooting, we're just never going to stop him. You know, with Green at center, I mean, I guess you would say, who does Howard guard? Does he guard Draymond Green? I think he'd do a better job of it than Mike Beasley would. That's for sure. That was another big mistake as well, to have Beasley in on the last possession where Draymond dribbled it off his foot.
Well, we should talk about the next possession first. So the Warriors get the ball back, and they end up with a Klay Thompson three that misses. And
yeah, in and out, so close too. I thought that was a great shot. Well, I don't know. So, I mean, they got the offensive rebound first, right? And they had tried to go for the 2-for-1 and couldn't get it. And then, you know, they got it to Klay. Klay shot it not quite early enough to get the 2-for-1. And when it missed, you wondered, like, all right, there was a 2-second differential. Were they going to foul or not? I mean, Klay was, I think, just pulled up right over Beasley from that far away, which was probably, I thought that was a good shot. It just didn't go down for them.
It was a little bit far, but it wasn't, you know, insane or anything like that. Oh, no, that was the next one that was far. But the thing that bothered me about that possession was the Warriors, with what ended up being a 2-second differential, you knew it was going to be really close. When the ball went up, the Warriors just kind of sat there and watched it float, and nobody really fought for the offensive rebound. And when you have when you have a 1-point deficit and that tight a differential, you're either going to foul or you're going to press. And either way, you want to have somebody near the ball. So you might draw a foul, you can do a lot of positive things, or you can actually get the ball and get it close to the basket. And to see everybody on this team that's full of smart guys, that's full of guys that generally have a rep for being hard workers, just completely not give it away, because they wouldn't have been the favorites to get the ball, but just to see them go, meh, in that kind of a possession was, let's just say, jarring.
Yeah, that's true. You usually see more of an effort for them in those late game plays, really getting to the offensive glass. And then they didn't foul at all, which was surprising. I think a lot of people were saying, hey, you got to start fouling. But, you know, that was kind of the right decision. And it ended up with that play where Ariza threw a bad pass to Beasley.
Another bad inbounder.
Well, it wasn't an inbounds. It was just on the...
Wasn't it an inbound?
On the sideline. No, they were trapping. And then they passed it.
Right, you're right.
And then Beasley lost it out of bounds. And, you know, it was called Houston's ball. These replays are kind of weird because it almost always looks like kind of that it's off the offensive player when a guy gets stripped like that, because you have the ball in two hands. It's got to go in some direction that goes past your hand, and, you know, you're going to kind of be moving in a certain direction before you even get stripped. And I thought that, you know, before we had super slow-mo replay, or if it's a pickup game, there's no question that's just, you know, Rockets ball. But now when you have that super slow-mo replay, I thought they made the right call that it was not conclusive. But it's a little bit almost unfair to the offense on some of these plays, that unless there is like a clear separation of the ball from the guy's hands and then he hits it again, I think that, you know, it should be interpreted as being the offense's ball, because it was clearly the defensive player who provided the impetus to send it out.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to draw the line, is if the ball is touching the guy's hand when he hits it and it never stops touching his hand, then it's out on the other guy. It's out on the defensive player.
So then they inbounded the ball from the baseline and with no timeouts left, and they ran a play. Nobody was able to get open. Great job by the Warriors. And then they tried to just lob it in to Mike Beasley, and Andre Iguodala just locked up his arm so he couldn't go and get the lob in. And they're able to get the steal. Harden actually really hustled back, poked it away from Livingston, and it went right to Clark. And Clark hit, you know, what appeared like it might be the game-winning layup with about 10 seconds left. And then Houston, I think, really benefited from the fact that they had no timeouts and were able to just have Harden bring it the length of the floor.
Yeah, and so Harden drove, and Klay decided not to help off Ariza, which I think he should have helped and just made that a tougher shot, or make him make that pass, because Ariza hadn't been nailing those, and I think you live with that shot a lot more than a free throw line jumper from Harden.
Yeah, part of the reason that the rule is never help off the strong side corner is because that's worth three. Well, if you're up one and you're at the end of the game, the other team has no timeouts, your goal is just prevent any bucket. It doesn't matter whether it's a two or a three, really, at that time. You just need to prevent a bucket. And I think that the shot that Harden was going to have was a higher percentage shot than Ariza shooting that corner three, especially Harden is used to taking those shots. Ariza isn't necessarily. Harden probably also not really that interested in passing. at that point in the game, but it developed so quickly and Harden got the push off on Andre so quickly, you know, it looked like Andre had him contained pretty well. And then by the time the push off occurred, you know, it wasn't really going to be possible for Clay to get in there anyway. You know, and Draymond Green might have been able to come over, but he also had Mike Beasley underneath. He maybe should have trusted the help behind him a little bit more to come in. I think it was Livingston on the weak side to take out Beasley, but you know, Harden just made a great play and yeah, he pushed off a little bit, but not a call that's going to be made at that time. And I think Andre just deactivated a little bit too much, kind of let himself get pushed just because, you know, that's what you do at most times of the game to try to sell the call. And that was a mistake, and Harden hit a really nice shot.
And unsurprisingly, considering a teammate hit a big shot in a game that was very important to them, the Rockets bench was excited and thrilled when the shot went in.
Well, Clint Capella was.
Yes, he was. That's why I love him.
Because he doesn't know any better to know that his vacation plans just got extended for another 3 days and he has to fly back to San Francisco as well. Howard, I actually understand why Howard wasn't in the greatest mood because he probably should have been in the game and he wasn't. And I mean, I think he probably felt like he'd played really hard and, you know, should have been in, and that he's theoretically one of the superstars on this team. So I understand, even if, you know, I think you should theoretically still be happy when your team wins. It makes a little bit more sense, but he, you know, and Terrence Jones, I think he's just, the fact that he hasn't even been playing at all, he's like totally disengaged. But yeah, it was pretty funny to see just like no reaction, you know, and this wasn't like the Jay Wright, like trying to play it cool. It was sort of like, you know, let's see here. And maybe they were looking to see how much time was left, but yeah, it's usually you'll see a little bit more excited reaction.
And so on the last possession, I actually asked some members of the press that were at the game. I don't know if they did ask.
So what happened was the play was for Spates, actually.
It was. No, that wasn't my question. My question was, why was Clay inbounding the ball?
I mean, I think the idea was just to have him go screen for Spates afterwards and to kind of get Ariza's momentum going down with Clay, so that then when the screen occurred on Howard, who actually had been reinserted at the end, that Clay could screen Spates. But, you know, it didn't matter at all because Draymond dribbled it off his foot. I mean, I think the other option would have been that Draymond could have driven, but with 2.7 left, you know, I'm a little skeptical that there was necessarily enough time for that. I mean, what I would have loved to see was to just inbound it to Draymond, guarded by Beasley, have screening action on either side, and then just have Draymond go right to the basket.
Exactly.
And just try to blow by Beasley, who, you know, can't defend anybody. But, you know, you don't know exactly who's going to be in the game for the other team. I think if there's 3.7 left, maybe I like that play call a little better. But when he dribbles it off his foot, probably doesn't really matter. It's kind of the second gaffe like that Green has made. You remember the Boston game, too. He kind of had they were running a play, and he had exactly what he wanted and lost it. Then I think his eyes just kind of got big, and he was looking to see what happened and just lost the ball.
So my beef with it was more two things. So I thought it wasn't enough time to do the play that they wanted. I thought the idea was solid. It's a lot to do in 2.7 seconds, especially since it involves the inbounder inbounding the ball and then making, you know, being an integral part of the play. And the second part is, Klay Thompson is many things. A good passer is not one of them. And
Was it a bad pass, though?
I thought it was a bad pass. It definitely
was it?
Yeah, it wasn't, like, terrible. It wasn't like he, you know, threw it off Draymond's head or something. But I think if it had been closer, then I think that, from what I saw, that was part of the reason why Draymond struggled a little bit to corral it and the ball went off his foot. That's my personal interpretation of it. I haven't watched it like the Zapruder film or anything like that. But that was what I saw live and on one replay. But
that's what Dunktown requires, Danny. We have to watch everything.
Not this game. But the general concept is, I understand the idea of Clay's role on the play and being, you know, kind of being a decoy, being an integral part of it. But he's just a bad passer. And I think that it's a problem in that kind of a circumstance to do that, especially when it's a quick moving thing. I would have tried to emphasize a different part of his offensive game.
Well, let's talk a little bit about a game that we will not be analyzing like the Zapruder film. And in fact, I will confess that I did not watch all that much of it, just in bits and pieces on the other TV while Pacers and Raptors was on the main TV. But Oklahoma City restored order. They won by 29. Looked like it was about that close. Amazingly, Kevin Durant did not shoot 7 of 33 with 7 turnovers. Again, Russell Westbrook was good. And then the guys who really killed it were the bench guys, Waiters and Cantor, who really killed their counterparts for the Mavs, which included David Lee, who returned and you know didn't really look all that great from what I was able to tell, and also was being played in kind of two big lineups a lot, which is not the best for him offensively. So he kind of got dominated by Cancer. They went right to Cancer in the post as soon as he and Lee were matched up. Cancer had 4 offensive rebounds, 21 points on only 7 shot attempts, was also 8 out of 10 from the line, and he was plus 17 in his 21 minutes. Was Cantor, and Waiters was plus 27 in his 28 minutes. So it was really the bench that completely destroyed Dallas in this
one. Yeah, plus we got Raymond Felton, Stephen Adams beef, which is just fantastic.
What happened on that?
So as I understand it, Felton was kind of grabbing at a little bit at Adams for going for a rebound, and Adams probably didn't know the height of the guy next to him, so he kind of swung his arm a little bit, and because Raymond Felton is much smaller than Stephen Adams, that hit him in the face, and Raymond Felton did not enjoy that. So then I think they both got texts. But it is amusing to see Stephen Adams, who is not only a big dude, but not a particularly nice dude, and I'm not saying he's a bad guy, I'm just saying he can play with some physicality, with having a little bit of beef with Raymond Felton, who is, you know, a larger fellow, but still 6'1", maybe, it was pretty enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, also enjoyable will be the next event you go to using the SeatGeek app. SeatGeek is the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, and they are a fantastic app for a number of reasons. One is that they aggregate all of the ticket buying sites together, so you don't have to worry that you're missing out on a deal if you didn't go to 8 different sites. It's all now right in front of you using SeatGeek. The second is that they have a metric called Deal Score that tells you whether a deal is fair or not fair. Green is a good value, bad maybe not so good. That also helps you sell your tickets on SeatGeek as well to make sure to get a fair price, but not to over or underprice your tickets. So that really helps. SeatGeek is also totally honest and upfront about the price. There's no hidden fees like you might have, say, on StubHub. So that really helps too. And you don't have to bother like putting in a bunch of squiggly letters either. SeatGeek is an app, so they know that you are you. And just a couple of swipes and you're good. Hopefully, though, one of those swipes will include going into the settings tab and clicking add a promo code. And you enter that promo code CapSpace. Everyone knows what the Dunked On promo code is. We talk about CapSpace all the time on the show. And SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code CapSpace today. All right, let's do some all defense teams, which of course everyone has been waiting for with bated breath. I thought it's a little bit more fun to do it with point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center, than the NBA rubric of guard, forward, centers. But you didn't do it yours that way, did you?
I didn't, but I can explain the difference. It's really just one dude.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So my all defense first team, and I also said you have to start or at least play 25 minutes a game, basically, for your team. Ricky Rubio was my point guard. Who was your point guard?
So I had 2 shooting guards. This is my difference. I had 2 shooting guards on the first team, and then I had 2 point guards on the second team.
All right, so who is your one of your 2 shooting guards then?
So one of my 2 shooting guards was Danny Green. I thought he was very, very good as a man-to-man defender for the Spurs this year. Of course, they had a dominant defense this year, and I think he did a great job.
Yeah, I had Danny Green as well as my shooting guard, and you know, so there wasn't a ton of competition. Avery Bradley can look incredibly good at times. So can KCP. But none of the advanced numbers particularly like those guys. And, you know, and kind of asking around why that would be, you know, for example, Avery Bradley has, I think, the worst on-court defensive rating of all of the Celtics regular rotation guys. Now, that obviously there's a lot to that. You know, he's always going to be in the game with the other team's best player. He's going to be guarding him, blah, blah. But when you have that kind of an issue, like, that is a pretty big statistical issue to have when you're saying this guy is the absolute best in the league at his position. And so I think the reason I went with Green is I think he's pretty good on the ball, but he's probably the best help defender as a 2-guard. He's also amazing on fast breaks as well. Every time someone goes in on a fast break, they either get stripped or get it blocked or miss the layup. And that's also kind of why he's really good as a help defender as well, for that same reason. Just, you know, he actually, rather than trying to take the charge all the time, he actually jumps and he causes big problems for guys. He just has great timing. So I think that's why I went with him. And then Rubio, At 6'5", he's capable of switching more than a lot of point guards are. He really competes hard. You know, at this point in time, your ability to play defense on the pick and roll, your ability to play denial defense as well, is kind of more important even than just your ability to stay with another point guard in just a straight up ISO, because those aren't plays that are run that much. It's more about getting over the pick in the pick and roll, continuing to compete, being able to bother the guy's shot from behind, even if you get screened off, which happens to everybody. And that's what I really liked about Rubio. And really, you know, other than Kevin Garnett, who didn't play very much, Rubio was fantastic defensively for Minnesota, and they actually were positive with him on the floor for the year, despite the fact that they won, you know, like whatever it was, 28 games this year.
Yeah, my decision for that second spot, so I had Danny Green as like the kind of inarguable first team guard. The other spot I was between Bradley and Rubio. I ended up going with Avery Bradley just because I think he's a little bit better of a man-to-man defender, but Rubio was the next choice, and he was my number one second team all defense guard.
Yeah, so how did you deal with the fact that just the numbers weren't that good for Bradley? You just think that's just an aberration?
Yeah, I think it's an aberration. When I watch the Celtics every once in a while, when you think about defensive rating, that's also surrounding talent, and Boston's interior defense was very hit or miss. And so, you know, sometimes you play with some of those lineups that just aren't very good there. And, you know, you have it where it's pairing also early on in the season. And at other moments, he's playing a lot more with Isaiah Thomas, who is probably their worst defensive guard. So I think that offsets it a little bit, and they would have trouble sometimes hiding Isaiah and things like that. So I'm okay with that, because when I watch him and, you know, and other people, I mean, the talk of him being one of the league's best perimeter defenders is not, you know, it's not an isolated thing. That's something that is out there. And I thought he did a nice job. I also thought he did well in some big moments. And, you know, it doesn't count in this at all, but I think that they did really, like, of course, we made these decisions before when the regular season ended, but I think that they have really missed him in the playoffs, and I think that confirmed to me that I feel like I made the right call. Though Rubio has had a wonderful season, and I'm not going to fight that vigorously at all.
Yeah, I also just felt like, you know, I wanted to have someone who actually plays point guard on offense who also was on there. You know, you can't have Danny Green and Avery Bradley as your backcourt. They're both kind of like shooting guards, but we just had like a different philosophy on that one. And I think Bradley, if there's like, all right, there's one high scoring guy that I want to shut down, point guard or, you know, some of the smaller shooting guards. I mean, that's part of the thing too. Bradley probably not as good at switching that much. And that's not something that the Celtics did. Like the fact they didn't need to switch because he can just be glued to his guy all the time. But because he's also glued to his guy all the time, he's not as much of a factor in help defense maybe as some other guys. And I think that is my hypothesis for why maybe some of his numbers, you know, both real plus minus, which adjusts for, you know, who he's playing with purportedly and also who is on the other team at a given time. You know, his real plus minus was like pretty low, I think on like the second page of shooting guards. So that's why I couldn't go with Bradley, even though by the eye test, just looking at him, I kind of liked him a little bit better. But, you know, the reason that we have statistics is because they see every game, and defensive statistics are not incredibly exact. But when they rated him so badly, I felt like, all right, you know, I have to give some respect to this, and I can't put him on my first team. I assume we were going to feel much more in agreement about our forward choice.
Kawhi Leonard, who we both picked for Defensive Player of the Year. Draymond Green, we both picked second.
Yes. All right, center. I went with Rudy Gobert. Not a great year for centers. Again, guys who were kind of injured more, didn't play that many minutes, weren't that consistent over the course of the year. So Gobert, despite the fact that he missed a fair amount of time, I thought that he's very versatile. We talked a lot about him and some of his qualifications. I picked him third for Defensive Player of the Year. You know, didn't feel great about that, but I mean, not that he's not a worthy candidate, but just that there are a lot of other people that he would have been competing with. But I felt like, you know, he probably should have been the first team center. I rated him third on my fictional Defensive Player of the Year ballot and felt no reason to change that now.
I love Rudy. He was my second team center, but I went with the guy who I picked for third Defensive Player of the Year, Tim Duncan. I thought he had a really nice year. He does have that specific flaw, which you love talking about against the Warriors, but I thought that his rim protection was very good this year. He's an underrated rebounder, and his blocked shots often go to his teammates. I thought he did a really nice job. Another integral part of one of the league's best defenses. I believe the best defensive pair in the NBA this year was Kawhi Leonard and Tim Duncan. Obviously, Kawhi Leonard is a big part of that, but Tim Duncan is too.
Yeah, I had Tim Duncan on my second team.
After all your venom, he still makes your second team.
Yeah, I mean, he's still really good. I just don't think he's like the absolute best. And there's not Venom. Like, he's still a really good defensive player. It's just, you know, we're talking about degrees here, basically. And you know, I still think he was fantastic, to be sure. Who else did you consider for those two center spots?
It was hard. I mean, there was a part of me that was interested in maybe like in DeAndre a little bit, but I didn't think he had the overall profile for it. You know, it was a really weak group. There was nobody else. Drummond had a nice start to the year, but he didn't end the year well enough for me to really consider him.
Yeah, I mean, Detroit's defense after the break was, I think below league average. So the center on a below league average defense. DeAndre was the only other guy that I would have considered. And I think if he can just continue to get a little bit more consistent, I was talking to an assistant coach the other day who said, he's underrated because of the amount of talking that he does, getting their defense set and what a role he plays there, which is, that's a big change for him based on, from before the days when Doc Rivers came in and he wasn't even closing games under Vinny Del Negro. So, I think DJ and certainly has played at the level of a first team all defense player these first two games in the playoffs. So we'll see. He just wasn't quite consistent enough for me, but I think he continues to get better and better. And I will, certainly be looking at him very heavily next year, assuming that he also plays way more minutes than either of those other guys. So that's why, I felt like the fact that he had so much more value than them over the course of the year made it pretty close to me, despite the fact that those two guys are kind of just better in a vacuum.
Yeah, this will matter a little bit later, but I consider all defensive teams to be more on the line of most outstanding than most valuable, because I'll have a guy who plays less minutes. I didn't know about your threshold. I think he still covered that, but I think it was more.
Yeah, well, that was just my own threshold. If I were actually voting for this award, I think I would just do it that way.
So I've already said one of my guards, so I might as well just give the second one. So Ricky Rubio was one, and the other one is also point guard, and I was really between two guys for this last spot, and it was between Chris Paul and Kyle Lowry. And while I think Chris Paul is the better defensive player, and that's a really weird caveat to say what I'm going to say, I put Kyle Lowry on the team because I thought he had a better defensive season. I thought that he was very important. Yes, Toronto finished below the Clippers in the rankings for the season, but I thought that Toronto had meaningfully worse defensive talent. DeAndre, as we just talked about, was consideration for third team, and Damari Carroll missed so much of the year. I thought Lowry did a really nice job stepping up and really covering some ground on that team. And, Chris Paul, obviously worthy consideration. I'm not going to fight anybody who puts him above Lowry, but I had Lowry a little bit ahead.
Yeah, I had Chris a little bit higher. I mean, I think they both are kind of stronger guys who compete really hard. I think Paul is a little bit better on ball. I think he's a little bit better at denying off the ball. I think he's a little bit better on switches as well. But Lowry is probably the better help defender, takes more charges, amazing at getting loose balls as well. He's one of the best loose ball retrieval guys in the entire league. I mean, that to me is kind of part of defense as well. But I went with Chris Paul just because I think he has a little bit better of a track record over the course of the entire year. And Lowry was really the only point guard other than George Hill that I had kind of on my honorable mentions. And then I guess I'll give some of my other guard. My second team was Avery Bradley at shooting guard. And then apologies to Jimmy Butler at shooting guard and KCP as well. Tony Allen didn't play quite as enough minutes, so I probably would say KCP out of the rest of those guys. I think he's kind of in the same boat a little bit as Bradley, where he is pretty quick, not that great of a help defender, really good at tracking guys around screens, but also maybe not as good at switching as someone like Danny Green would be, since he's a little bit stronger and can kind of hold up. So those are the guys I had. Anybody else at the guard position that you felt like deserved some consideration?
Well, you mentioned Jimmy Butler. I mean, if Butler had played a little bit more and played a little bit better, I think that, because he got a lighter defensive responsibility this year, which is good because his offensive game was strong this year. He had a good year, but I think that I considered him, but he ended up falling by the wayside. And the reason I went with, Bradley and Danny Green over KCP is that I didn't feel like Caldwell Pope was as consistent enough. He's a very good player, and when he turns it on, he's incredible, but he had some kind of stinkers of games in not high profile, because the Pistons, they didn't really play those, high intensity games. And so he's the next tier below, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if next season he's, you know, in this conversation, possibly in this conversation, in a better position. You know, we're talking about why he got it over somebody else.
Yeah, Jimmy Butler gets talked about sometimes in the same conversation as Kawhi and Paul George. I think that's because he is almost as good as those guys are against, like, power wings like LeBron or Carmelo, but he doesn't have the length that those guys have, and he's not quite as good at dealing with smaller players, not quite the shot blocker or steals guys that those guys are, especially on the ball. He kind of uses his body more defensively, and he doesn't have the added threat of stealing the ball or blocking a shot that those guys do. I mean, he still is very good and can make guys very uncomfortable, but I that's why I don't have him quite on the level of those guys. And then at forward, my second team fours were Paul George and Derek Favors with Utah, although I'm a little bit regretting not giving more of a look to Paul Millsap than I did, and he was one of my near misses, along with Al-Farouq Aminu and Jay Crowder among those forward guys.
So I heavily considered both of the guys that you chose and Paul Millsap. Paul Millsap was actually my last cut. But the two that I gave it to, one was Jay Crowder, who I thought was fabulous. Again, this goes into the difference that we had where, for me, the time that he missed in some ways helped his case just because Boston didn't do that great of a job without him. I don't care that he missed that time. I thought he was, we talked about this a long time ago on a 15 and 60, but that he was probably their most impactful defender. I mean, this is a very strange team to be as good as they were defensively without that real rock solid big man. I thought Jay Crowder did a fabulous job for them. And then the second spot is kind of a cheap homer pick in that sense. But Andre Iguodala, I think, was vital to the Warriors' defense. He is kind of the other linchpin of the death lineup defensively, and the reason that works in a lot of different ways. And again, this goes into the different philosophies for the two of us. I thought he was the next most outstanding defender, though obviously he provided substantially less value because he not only missed time but played less.
Yeah, I should have included Andre on my honorable mention. And Jay Crowder, I wouldn't have had him quite as high. He's real good at steals. He's strong. He's got the ability to switch. I'm just not quite sure he's just the one-on-one lockdown guy maybe that, you know, some of these other guys are. And I also, just because I went with a power forward and a small forward, that's why I went with Favors. Favors has the ability to switch out in the perimeter really well. He can also slide to center, which is versatile. He's a great defensive rebounder and, you know, really strong, impossible for any other power forward to post up, you know, if anyone still tries that anymore at the power forward position. But he's able to get out on shooters when healthy as well. So that's why I went with him, but that was very close with Millsap, who, you know, is certainly an excellent player.
One thing I noticed when doing this was how few, if we're talking real small forward wing defenders, there are in the league right now. You know, there aren't those guys who you're just sitting there going, oh, you just throw them out on a guy. You know, the Tony Allens of the world, the prime LeBrons, you know, there just don't seem to be as many of those guys. There are a couple, of course, but it seems like that group has thinned out.
Yeah, well, that's because you need guys who can actually shoot now, too. You know, I mean, there's a guy like Andre Robertson might develop into that, you know, sort of the old school guy like a Michael Curry or a Trenton Hassel, that kind of guy who now is just unplayable. And Tony Allen was almost unplayable. He had an offensive renaissance this year. But, you know, those guys, you can't get away with just those total specialists on the wing anymore because they're just not going to get guarded, and it'll take away more points on offense than they get you on defense.
Yeah.
All right, some news. Nicola Batum, per Chris Haynes, he reported that Batum is expected to miss the rest of the series versus the Heat. Rick Bonnell in Charlotte pushed back on that a little bit, saying that he is not out for all seven games of the series, but he expects he will effectively be out for the series because he thinks it'll be over in four or five games anyway, which is a pretty good tweet from a beat guy. But he has definitely been ruled out for game three, and you also have to imagine if he comes back that he's going to be kind of limited as well. So obviously, I still think the Hornets will win one of those two home games, but you have to imagine that five is going to be about it for them in that series with no Batum.
Yeah, it's certainly a shame, and it would have been fun to see these teams really go at it as at what counts as full strength without Chris Bosh, but, you know, injuries do happen.
So Scott Brooks, five-year, $35 million contract in Washington, $7 million a year. He joins fellow Warren Legere clients Ernie Grunfeld and Tommy Shepard in Washington. They met out on the West Coast for the last couple of days and kind of change things, work things out of how things were going to go for the team. All five of those years are guaranteed, according to David Aldridge, which is pretty remarkable. So that they are really committing to Brooks for the long haul. However, Woj reporting that this doesn't really change anything for Kevin Durant, and they are still a pretty big long shot to get him. All that business aside, what do you think of this hire for the Washington Wizards?
I'm kind of two minds. So I think that Scott Brooks has been a little bit unfairly maligned. He wasn't the perfect coach for Oklahoma City. I do think that he wasn't the right guy to lead them to the promised land, but he does a lot of other things well. They actually cared on defense and tried hard, and he, you know, they had a lot of skill development while he was the coach of that team. How much of that goes to him and other people is hard to know. However, I thought that he was a really natural fit for, you know, more of a young team to build that, to do maybe be the next step up from a guy like Scott Skiles and, you know, take a team like that Orlando, like what Orlando did last year, and make them better and lay the foundation. And then when you need to get the Steve Kerr type coach to the real tactician, once the team already has the core fundamentals in place, then you're set up for that. And with Brooks, Washington has defended well, except for this year when they were garbage. They've defended pretty well, and a lot of the reason they were bad this year is because they changed the personnel to be more up-tempo and to be more fast, and so they took away some of their best defenders. And so they don't really need that kind of a buy-in. However, I do think that they have players that can develop more and that can get better. Oubre and Otto Porter are talented young guys. They can get better than they are right now, but it doesn't seem like the Scott Brooks job to me.
No, it doesn't. I think that's probably right. Now, Brooks has a very good record just in the aggregate in Oklahoma City. You know, I think like a Scott Brooks job would have been, you know, if Sacramento were sane, it would be there. Orlando, I think he would have been, you know, excellent there. You know, kind of a team that still hasn't quite made it, that is out of the playoffs, to be that developmental coach, help guys develop individually, build strong relationships, get guys to commit, get guys to try. You know, the sort of team that really has had trouble in the effort categories. And, you know, I think Phoenix actually would have been, you know, a pretty decent one for him as well with some of their young guys. You know, that's the kind of fit I was thinking of for him, because in a lot of ways, you know, he's not as gruff as Randy Whitman, but he strikes me as having some of the same drawbacks that Whitman would have. I mean, and you know, granted, he's had some success, and Washington really wanted him the whole time, and they feel very strongly about it. I think they feel very strongly that he is someone that they can work with within their front office to get some good synergy, all be on the same path. But, you know, Brooks struggled in Oklahoma City crafting a modern offense. He struggled in Oklahoma City, you know, with his personnel usage going small. He got them to defend, but it wasn't due to, like, any necessarily great tactics. It's because they had some amazing athleticism on the team. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, when Scott Brooks was in the league, I mean, was anyone talking about him as like a top half of the league coach?
Yeah, I don't think he had that. We've discussed before offline and on the podcast about how there are a few clear positives, a few clear negatives, and then a bunch in the middle. And to me, he never stepped out of the middle. He's on the positive side of the middle, but not immensely so.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be bad.
No.
You know, like, but I think this is a team that can't.
But they didn't pay him $7 million a year to not be bad.
Although $7 million a year, I think is, I mean, who knows how much Earl Watson got. But, you know, for guys who have been coaches in the league before and had success, I mean, I think that's what it's going to be, because
right.
there's so
I
much
probably
more money
have
in the league.
I focused on
now.
The 5
that's
years
the
than the 7 mil.
Yeah, the 5 years all guaranteed is quite a bit. And you have to, the Wizards are not a team that typically is swimming in cash. They actually get, I think, a fair amount of revenue sharing. And just due to the transplants or the fact that the team was so bad or whatever, they have never really built up much equity. So they're one of the lowest revenue teams in the league. So for them to make this kind of a commitment, I don't see them moving on from him if it doesn't work out. And just this is just, it's not a high ceiling move.
No.
I would say.
It's also great to get a guy who has synergy with a general manager when the general manager should be on the hot seat. Like, hey, great, look, yeah. we have such good chemistry. Give him 5 years and we're going to work really well together. That's a really nice kind of sneaky solidifying your own place move.
Yeah, and maybe part of this is that they think they have a better shot at Durant than they do, you know, or maybe this is just they believe that they have a 20% chance now and they had a 5% chance before or whatever. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he'll be fine, but I feel like sometimes that this group, as you alluded to, might be outside of what Brooks has kind of demonstrated core competencies are.
Yeah, if the Lakers were more patient, he might have been a nice fit for them. but that's not.
Yeah, that actually would be another one, right? With some young guys there, and also a team that theoretically wants Kevin Durant too, but you know they haven't moved on from Byron Scott yet, and now maybe two of their best candidates are off the market.
Can I give you my Lakers theory?
Oh yeah, let's hear this.
I think they're going to have Byron Scott for another year. Then they're going to overhaul a little bit larger scale, and then they'll bring in Luke Walton.
Yeah, maybe that's right. But then, you know, and the whole bus Phil Jackson thing coming back, like there's all that.
Right,
too,
I think it ties in.
And Woj, again, he had a column on Thibodeau going to Minnesota, and he said the Lakers basically missed out because with how fractious they are at this point, Thibs wanted personnel power, and they can't even agree, you know, which of them is going to have the power, much less that they're now going to turn over everything to some outsider. So it seemed like that was never really going to be a good fit with this ownership group.
You know what? I understand why it didn't happen, but Brooks would have been a really nice fit for New Orleans last year.
Yeah, that might have been the case too, although I think he actually... Did he get fired before or after they fired Monty? I can't remember.
He also had
money left on his contract too, which was
right. And they wanted to go in, I think, more of a veteran direction, which was a mistake. But I think they wanted to basically. I think they thought they had more together, and so they maybe like what we thought about the Wizards. They were thinking about that themselves. Is just that those veteran guys they added just weren't that good.
I mean, I think of Monty and Scott Brooks as being kind of similar too, frankly. And I will be dead honest. I thought that Alvin Gentry was a much better candidate than Scott.
So did I.
And that may have ended up being incorrect. Also, one error that we made, or I made actually, I said that Tom Thibodeau's contract with the Bulls was over. That is not the case. He actually had one more year on that at $4 million. So the Bulls now are getting that money back with the offset. But I think Thibodeau still made the right decision, especially given how much he's getting paid in Minnesota and striking while the iron was hot with that franchise to get full personnel power with a team that already has that much talent on the roster is quite the coup.
Congratulations to that cash poor Bulls ownership.
Hey, they didn't make the playoffs this year. They're hurting. What we got to plug before we go?
I got a couple things. So I mentioned it yesterday, but it's actually out now. The offseason preview for the Minnesota Timberwolves. I thought it was a fun exercise to go through what they're really dealing with. And then also I recorded a Real Jam Radio episode with James Hamm, who is the Kings insider for CSN California. And we talked for an hour and a half on a lot of different things with that team, the coaching search, DeMarcus, Rajon Rondo, and a whole bunch of other stuff, who he sees as the long-term pieces. And I personally find the Kings one of the more fascinating situations, and he's as plugged in as anybody. So if you want to know a lot more about the Kings than you do right now, you can listen to that.
For us, programming note, we will be back on Sunday night talking about the Saturday and Sunday games, maybe the Friday games as well if they're really good. And you know, we might do an emergency pod if there's like an absolute classic game. But I mean, none of these series really seem to even be that close right now to where we would do that. So probably talk to you all on Sunday. Thanks so much for listening. Follow me on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Talk to you then.